I sure hope this helps someone. It hurts all over again to know that there's someone out there feeling the way I felt.
Well, my name is Cleo DeLoner. I'm 45 years old, and I'm originally from New Mexico in the Four Corners area. So I was born in 1970, May 25th. It was a rare stormy evening on a Monday night. No, 23:50 hours, 11:50 p.m. My mom was 18 when she had me. She already had two kids. She was full-blood Hispanic. She married a Native American man. So three of my siblings are very Native American. My youngest brother is full-blood Hispanic. He's 6 years younger than me. And I showed up white with blonde curly hair. I am the product of a rape, apparently by a white man. She was an extreme abusive alcoholic. And I was a constant reminder to her of her trauma. I was a human being, so she couldn't just lock me in a closet and forget about me. So she was extremely abusive as she took it out on me. Punching, slapping, kicking. You know, I should have aborted you. I found you under a rock. I found you in a trash can. You're not my real kid. My brothers and sisters learned very quickly that if they did anything wrong, they'd get blamed on me, and I'd get the shit kicked out of me, even if I wasn't there, you know. At random times, she would just decide that I didn't get to eat dinner that night. And I remember my sister sneaking in slices of bread to me at night in my room. When I was three, my sister... She had seen my mom smoking, and she wanted to see what it was like smoking. She was four. And my mom was outside hanging the wash on her clothesline. So my sister went into my mom's room, and she took a cigarette and a book of matches, and she took me by the hand and took me into the bathroom. She closed the door, and she put the cigarette in her mouth like she saw my mom doing. And she's trying to strike the match, but she's four, right? So it wasn't really working too well. Just as my mom came in, she heard the screen door slam, and she got the match lit. And she got scared, and she dropped it into the trash can with stuff on fire, got the shower curtain on fire. So she blamed it on me. And so to teach me a lesson to not play with fire, my mom sat me down and held me down and went through an entire book of matches one by one, lit match over the back of my left hand, through the whole book of matches. I have a third-degree burn scar here. It's covered up with a tattoo now. A couple years ago, I took a book of matches, and I struck a match, and I counted how long it took to burn out, about 15 seconds, and there's 20 matches in a book, and so that's about 5 minutes of burning. And so I was terrified of fire. Still am, actually, even though I smoke. I won't let new people light my cigarette, you know, make sure it's completely out. She would make me light the gas stove, because she knew I would be scared when the flame come up. She would hold my hand over it, and stuff like that. I was a bedwetter. For a long time because of the abuse, apparently, and I don't remember this, but my sister has told me that I was sexually abused and molested by one of our uncles on her dad's side, because he's not my dad. But when I would wake up in the morning and I'd have pea-soaked underwear, you know, my mom would get just furious, and she would make me take the underwear off, and she would rub the pea-soaked underwear on my face. And she wouldn't let me wash my face. She'd make me go to school like that, no shower or anything, call me Peapot. So I started learning, well, if I get up early and hide my pea-soaked underwear and change them, you know, she won't know. So I would get up early and change my underwear, and I would ball up the pea-soaked ones and hide them between the mattress and the wall. And, of course, you know, the smell started getting pretty bad, and she found my stash, and I was severely punished. So also when I was three... she was tired of waking up with a hangover on Sunday mornings with four screaming kids, a different man coming out of her room every weekend. So she called all the local churches to see who ran a bus to pick up kids for Sunday school and church. And it was the First Southern Baptist Church. One Sunday she got me all dressed up in my little dress and did my long curly hair. And I'm like, where am I going? She said, you're going to church. Well, what's church? Well, you'll find out when you get there. So off I went to church, and we were required to go to church every Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night until either we turned 18 and graduated from high school. Well, over the years, I learned very quickly that my life was not normal, and that not all adults, you know, beat the crap out of you and yell at you and stuff. And so I started seeking parental figures, and church became my safe haven, and I looked forward to it. And as I grew up in the church and I accepted Christ at 9 years old, became a Christian, started playing trumpet in the fifth grade at 10. So I would do solos at church and play in the orchestra and stuff. And it got to the point where if I got in trouble, she would ground me from church because she knew how much I loved it. And so she would punish me that way. And so as I grew in the church, you know, and the deacons and the pastor, you know, learned about my childhood and my life. And so on Saturdays they would come over and they would try to save my mom. You know, and she'd be nice. She'd invite a man, offer him coffee, let him talk to her. And she's like, no, thanks. I don't need your God. I don't need your Jesus. Please leave. And then I'd get the shit kicked out of me, you know, for bringing the preacher man over. I'm like, guys, you got to stop. You don't understand. You know, you're not going to save her, first of all. And second of all, you know, I'm getting the crap kicked out of me, you know, for you guys trying to do this. So all through junior high, high school, I played sports, baseball, ran track, played basketball. Soccer was my love. Was orchestra band, jazz band, concert band, marching band. I was a very gifted and talented trumpet player. So when I turned 18, I left to go to college in Las Cruces, New Mexico, which is in southern New Mexico, about 40 miles from the border of El Paso, Texas. And I was a criminal justice and sociology major. And I was very involved in the Baptist Student Union and my church and the band, marching band, jazz band, concert band, pet band, all that stuff. I was extremely emotionally disturbed in college. And I didn't really realize it until a couple years ago. I found my journal from college, and, you know, talking about suicide all the time and self-harming. I actually started cutting when I was 13, and I cut on my face, right below my right eye. And the first time I cut, I remember me and my buddy were painting my bedroom blue, and we had a bare light bulb. And he had walked out of the room to get something, and I was painting around the light bulb. Well, the paintbrush touched the bulb, and it blew up. And for some reason, you know, I just picked up the glass and just started slashing my face with it. And my buddy came and he's like, oh my God, what happened to your face? Well, the light bulb exploded. True story, yeah, I'm not lying, you know. And that started my journey into self-harm and cutting. And it was such a relief, it was just this emotional release. You know, you would rather feel physical pain than emotional pain. And it became a constant thing. And I would sometimes use my dog's claws, you know, on her paw. And what happened? Oh, you know, I got scratched by my dog. And all those excuses. And, you know, I know that so many people, when they cut, they generally cut in a place where it's hidden, you know, where they can wear long sleeves or in the inside of their thighs. And it's always been, it was at some point a mystery as to why I would cut on my face where it was so obvious. But I think it was just, you know, my way of saying, hey, I'm hurting. I'm in pain. You know, somebody help me. I'm bad here. But I would always make up excuses as to the cutting. And so in college, I was cutting quite a bit, and even when... Motherfuck! Okay, that was not fucking hua. That was huge. That was more than a backfire.
What is that?
That was an explosion. Probably some high-powered fuel type fucking thing. So, yeah, we should hear sirens anytime. Okay, that's really not cool. You think somebody called 911?
I have no idea.
I think I should call 911.
Okay.
I'm sure somebody has already, but, okay, how do I get to the keypad? There it is. Do you know the address here?
No.
Squaw Peak Resort.
I can find it.
All right, pull it up real quick. All operators are busy. You got the address?
Not yet.
What the fuck is it?
We are at the Squaw Peak.
Paris Hilton Squaw Peak.
Paris Hilton Squaw Peak. Or, I'm sorry, Point Hilton Squaw Peak Resort, 7677 North 16th Street. Two massive explosions just occurred, about 10 seconds apart. I'm sorry, say again? 7677 North 16th Street?
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure. She's getting the fire department on the line.
I don't see anything.
I don't see either. That's what's scary. 7677 North 16th Street. Two massive explosions just happened about 10 seconds apart. I can't tell. I don't see any smoke. I don't see smoke. I don't see fire. One was just incredibly massive. Well, I'm outside in the courtyard, so I don't know about any kind of power being lost. It's a... you know what? It seemed really close. Probably 100 yards from me, maybe. Negative. I do not see smoke. Sure. All right. They just said thank you.
Okay.
I know, right? What the fuck is this?
I guess they're going to wait for more calls.
Yeah, who knows? Anyways.
How often do you hear things like that at a hotel? I don't know.
That was massive. She said, oh, it could have been a transformer. It looks a little hazy over there. You think?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't tell.
Okay.
Anyways, where were we? Do you remember? College.
College, yes.
The self-harm, you know, at some point I started punching myself over and over and over in the right side of my face. I had horrible shiner, swollen eye. I would slam my face into my desk in my dorm room. I started doing counseling, I think, early on. And, you know, one of the counselors I had was actually at age 20. And he was a Presbyterian minister and a social worker. And after about 6 months of counseling, we argue back and forth to this day who decided to sever the client-patient relationship and become friends. But that's what happened, and I got another therapist. But, you know, he invited me into his family. His wife was a psychologist and had two kids, like 7, 8 years old. And here we are 24 years later, and we're still, you know, super close friends. He's my pseudo-father. As a matter of fact, he gave me away at my wedding. But anyway, so... I was pretty much an emotional, depressed, suicidal wreck in college, and I always wanted to be a police officer, and I was too young to get into the police academy. You had to be 21, and I was really bored with college, and I wasn't doing that great anyway. So I joined the Army to be a military police soldier, and I joined on my 21st birthday. Went into a recruiter's office and took the oath. And that October of 91, I shipped out to Fort McClellan, Alabama, for my basic training and my advanced individual training, which is military police school. And, you know, it was tough, emotionally, mentally tough. It wasn't so physically tough, because I was a fit athlete, you know, was very strong, could run really fast. So when I got done with MP school, my orders came down, and I got ordered to Fort Bliss, Texas, which was in El Paso, Texas, which was 40 miles from where I just spent the last 3.5 years in college. I was like, really? You know, I was thinking Korea, Germany, you know, Hawaii, someplace. I'd been to El Paso, you know, numerous times. So there I was, stuck in El Paso, Texas. And I just really embraced being a soldier and a warrior and just thrived at it. Loved it. Loved my job. Loved being a cop. And in 92... Hurricane Andrew happened in Florida, and so our unit was deployed to Hurricane Andrew. I believe it was October of 92, and we were only out there for about a month. And I don't, you know, I want to make it abundantly, my memory is really bad because I have a traumatic brain injury and et cetera, but I'll get to that. But so I don't have a lot of recollection of my time in Hurricane Andrew. We were there only for a month, but we did mostly traffic control because all the lights were out and stuff. And so we did a lot of traffic control. And we got back to Bliss, and then the thing in Somalia, Africa, happened. There was a genocide on a biblical scale, 300,000 dead in genocide. The warlord there was using starvation as a weapon, and he was feeding his militia before women and children, and they were just slaughtering everybody. And so for the first time in history, you know, the world actually showed that it cared about the people in Somalia. And George Bush Sr. Addressed the American people in December of 92 and said he's authorizing U.S. forces to go to Somalia. And so our unit was tasked to deploy out to Somalia. And we left in 12 January of 1993. And the first American boots that hit the ground in Somalia was in December of 92. Ironically enough, 2 years ago, or 2 days ago, was the 23-year anniversary of the first American boots hitting their soil. So we got in country in early January of 93. And, you know, it was, the country is in shambles. And it was a quote-unquote humanitarian mission, right? We were going there to feed the starving and save the country. And I remember stepping off the plane, and I was just suffocated by the heat. It was 130-degree weather out there. And we were in full combat gear. And being MPs, we wore bulletproof vests under our flak jackets, so it was even more hot. And I remember stepping off the plane and just being suffocated by the heat. I'm just like, ooh, you know, it takes your breath away. And I remember looking around and thinking, all right, this could be interesting. And it didn't hit me until they started issuing us live ammo, ammunition, hand grenades and real bullets. And I'm like, oh, shit. And it's a real thing. I mean, I might have to kill somebody. I might get killed, you know. And I remember when we drove from the airport, which isn't like any kind of airport you would find. You're in the U.S. I mean, it was in shambles. And the runway was almost all dirt. And we had to land. It was a very rough landing. But in driving from the airport to the University of Mogadishu, which again is not like a university that you and I would know here, but we drove through the city and the marketplace, and the Somalis were everywhere, and they were filthy, and their feet were filthy. I remember hardly any of them had shoes, and the streets were filthy. It was just strewn with trash, and the Somalis were like, America, America, cigarette, cigarette, water, water, America, water, water, we love you, water, water, America. And it was just, it was complete culture shock. And, you know, you don't see that kind of stuff here in the U.S. unless, of course, you go into the slum of the slums of the major cities. And so we got to the university, and we had some downtime because the Somalis were cleaning out the areas that we were going to be housed in. And so once that was done, you know, we set up our cots and our foot lockers and everything, and very tight quarters. And we proceeded to work, digging trenches for latrines, bathrooms, showers. And so that first night in country, you know, I hadn't been in there, you know, maybe 12 hours. And we got in country at 8 o'clock that morning. And that night, being my gunner, drew the motor pool guard. We had to guard all the vehicles. And we're sitting on the hood of a Humvee, leaning against the windshield. And he, you know, I didn't know the kid, and he didn't know me, and he's babbling about Dungeons and Dragons and his new wife, and he was 20 years old and I was 22, and I was the highest ranking. And he's just gabbing along, you know, and we hear a shot, bam. We look at each other and say, is that an accidental discharge? And then the shit just opened up, boom, 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 boom. So we rolled off each side of the Humvee onto the ground, and I called out to him underneath the Humvee. I'm like, Percy, you okay? And he's like, yeah, I'm good. And the motor pool sergeant came out, and he was wearing his Kevlar helmet, his flak jacket, his flip-flops, shower shoes, his PT uniform, you know, his T-shirt and shorts, and he had his M16. It was the funniest thing, you know. And he called out. He's like, who's out there? And I told him, and he says, come in, I'll cover you. So I sent my gunner first, and he did 3 to 5 second rushes as we were trained, got into the building, And then I did 3 to 5 second rushes, got into the building. Anytime we got any kind of fire, we would, everything would run on generators because there was no electricity in this country. And so we killed the generators and everything went to black out and it was black. And so the Motor Patrol Sergeant asked me if I had the night vision goggles. And I said, Roger that, Sergeant. He goes, I want you to bring up security on the rear of this corridor. I said, Roger that. So I'm walking down this corridor. I got my M16, you know, pointed out. And just as I come up to the very edge of the corridor, this lieutenant, he was scared to death. He jumps out with his 9mm pistol, and he has it on my forehead. And he's shaking so bad, the barrel of the gun is bouncing off my forehead. And he's like, freeze, freeze. I was like, don't you fucking shoot. I'm an American. Don't you fucking shoot. And he's like, what's going on? I said, I don't know, sir. Put your fucking weapon down. Put your weapon down and take cover. He was just freaking out. I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to get shot by friendly fire my first day in country. So I did the duck squatting position, put on my night vision goggles, and watched across the street. And you could see soldiers doing 3 to 5 second rushes, going up the ladders to the fighting positions on the roofs and stuff. And we were in a blackout for about 6 hours, even though the firing had stopped long before. And so that was my first night in country. And, I don't remember a lot of my time in Somalia, again, because of my memory. I was there for 4 months, and I do remember on our 9th day in country, we were doing a food convoy escort 150 miles outside of Mogadishu, and MPs work in 3-man teams, and we have a driver, which I was, and an alpha driver or assistant driver, and we have a gunner. And so I was a driver for a squad leader, and they assigned us as the point vehicle, which is the vehicle that rides 3 or 4 miles ahead of the actual convoy to prevent ambushes. And we have a backup vehicle, which is called a wing vehicle, that rides about 75 to 100 meters behind us. And so we're cruising along, and we come around this slight curve in the road, and there were 3 bandits, gunmen, Somali guys with AK-47s, and they were holding up a cattle car, what we call a cattle car. It's just a very large vehicle with about 80 Somalis clinging to them. We used to call them Klingons. And none of the vehicles had windshields to make more seating space for people on the hood to hold on to the windshield area. Anyways, they were robbing these civilians with AK-47s. And they saw us, and they just immediately opened fire on us. And I stopped the vehicle, and the first thing I did was get on the radio. Halt the convoy, halt the convoy, we're taking fire. And they're like, say again. I said, halt the convoy, we're taking fire. So they're shooting at us, we're shooting at them. The Somalis are screaming. The radio is going crazy. Bullets are flying everywhere. It was complete and total fucking chaos. And my gunner in the turret, he had what's called a Mark 19 grenade launcher weapon. And it's a belt-fed grenade launcher. You know how Rambo wears the ammo? That's a belt-fed M60. So it's grenades. They're 40-millimeter grenades. And when one detonates, its kill zone is 50 meters. Everything within 50 meters is turned to dust. And it has an internal clicking device. If it rotates so many times without impact, it'll detonate in midair. And otherwise, it'll detonate on impact. And so we're firing and firing and firing. I'm going left, back, right, forward, trying to get a good combat position to fight. And my gunner launched 3 grenade rounds downrange. Who knows what he destroyed? I mean, he was terrified. And then the weapon jammed. And I remember my squad leader yelling at Piercy, get the 19 up, get the 19 up. He goes, it's jammed, Sergeant. He goes, what do you mean it's fucking jammed? Are you trying to get us fucking killed? And our lieutenant and our platoon sergeant, who were 3 and 7 miles behind us, were arguing over the radio about what they were going to do to help us. Well, firefights don't generally last very long. There was nothing they could do to help us. But they were tying up the net, and I had no communication, no commo, with my wing vehicle. They couldn't see the gunman. They thought we were taking fire from this group of civilians in this truck, and they were about ready to mow them down with an M60. And so when I finally got the vehicle positioned, it was on an angle like this, kind of off the hardball into the sand, and my squad leader jumped on top of the roof of the Humvee, and he's pulling back on the charging handle of the Mark 19, trying to release the grenade that was jammed, and he couldn't do it. And so he said, fuck it. So he lays down on his stomach in the prone position, and he's firing at the bad guys. My gunner's firing is 9mm, and so he didn't have a hold of the weapon, and it was slowly rotating in the turret because of the angle of the vehicle. And just as my squad leader fired off a round, the ammo can landed it right in his line of fire, and he fired a round through the ammo can. Just a massive explosion. It rocked the whole Humvee, back and forth like this. You know how big Humvees are. And I remember looking up and grabbing my gun, just like, what the fuck was that? And it was just fucking chaos. And there was about a good 3 minute span of time that none of us remember. But we didn't lose consciousness, you know. And the next thing I remember is we cleared the area, and I got on the radio and I called the convoy, all clear. And another MP company had come towards us on the MSR, the main supply route. And I remember standing out in the middle of the road and talking to these other soldiers. And we get to our relay point where we drop off the convoy to another MP company who's going to take it the rest of the way, deliver the food, come back, and we would take the empty convoy back to Mogadishu. I remember my gunner, he came up to me and he's like, he couldn't even make a complete sentence. And, you know, this guy lived by a code of honor, and he knew every weapon we had, forward, backwards, upside down, reversed, mirrored, in his sleep, whatever. And he came up to me, he's like, he was white as a sheet, and he's like, alive, we're alive. Mark 19, explode, we're alive. Why are we alive? I remember grabbing him by the shirt, and I said, I don't know why we're fucking alive, just fucking deal with it. And I shoved him. And our squad leader had talked to the explosive ordnance, EOD, and told him what had happened. And they said, hey, why don't you go recover that ammo can? Because the ammo can's about this big, shredded metal. And we threw it off the truck, off the Humvee. And EOD asked my sergeant, you know, hey, why don't you go recover that ammo can? He goes, hey, why don't you go fuck yourself? He goes, I'm not going to send my team back out there. He goes, I'll give you the coordinates. You guys can go recover it. So they did, and they came back with this mangled metal. Couldn't even identify what it was. And they told my squad, they're like, you know, we don't know how you guys are alive. There must have been angels floating around your vehicle, because we should be picking you guys up with a dustbuster right now. This doesn't make any sense at all. So I think it was not even a couple weeks later, our mission was the gate security. And like I said, MPs work in two-man teams. And so we would have two MPs at the main gate, and the third MP was in what we call an overwatch position, which was about 75 yards back and sitting in a Humvee with an automatic weapon behind sandbags and stuff. And their job was to lay down suppressive fire if the main gate got overrun by the enemy. So our job at the gate was really just any vehicle that was coming through the gate, if it was an American vehicle or one of our allies, we just made sure that their weapon was secure, not loaded, because they're entering a secure compound. If it was a Somali vehicle that was coming on the compound to do work, we had to search it, search the Somalis. So on this day, for some reason, my squad leader decided he wanted to just kind of take a break, and he was going to be in the overwatch position, which left me and my gunner at the main gate. And again, I was the highest ranking. And so, you know, there we are, and we see this crowd of Somalis. We actually heard them first, you know, in their lingo. And we look, and there's just this massive crowd coming towards us. We're like, holy shit, here we go. They're going to riot. So I call on the radio to my sergeant, to the overwatch position. I told him, stand by, keep an eye. You know, we got a large group of natives approaching the gate. And as it got closer, we could hear this god-awful scream like I've never heard before. And we quickly realized they didn't intend us any harm. And they came up to the gate, and the crowd kind of dispersed. And in the middle of the crowd was this little 10-year-old boy, about 12, and he was on a wheelbarrow. Again, not like a wheelbarrow like you and I would know. It was a slab of wood here and a slab of wood here with wooden handles and kind of a flat tire. And he was on this wheelbarrow, and he had his knees up to his chest, and he's shaking like this, and he was just covered in blood and just screaming. And his little buddy was like, a medic, doctor, doctor, please, a medic. And he was just crying and screaming, and the kid was screaming, and the Somalis were... And I looked down to find the source of the blood, and I saw three wounds. His left heel was completely blown off. I mean, just gone. And the back of both his calves had a gaping hole, probably about 4 inches long and 2 inches deep and about 3 inches wide. They were just blowing out. And from his heel, you know, it was like muscle and bone and nerves and shit just hanging out. It's completely blown off. And so, you know, in a situation like that, you have to assess very, very quickly. To see what, you know, to treat the most severe wound. I'm not a medic, so I don't carry medical supplies, but we do have a bandage that we carry on our person. And so I put rubber gloves on. I got on the radio and I called command. Command, this is main gate. This is main gate over there. Go ahead, main gate. And I said, right to that. We need a medic at the main gate ASAP. I said, I got a boy that's injured. He's bleeding out. He's going into shock. We need a medic now. They're like, stand by main gate. So I took my field dressing out of my pack. And I'm looking. And I'm like, Jesus, I don't know where to put the fucking dressing, you know. And so I assessed very quickly that it was the heel that was the worst off. So I bandaged the heel. And I'm yelling at my gunner, give me your field dressing, give me your field dressing. And he was just, you know, his eyes were like this. He just froze. And he was just in complete shock. And so I had to actually, you know, take his field dressing off his equipment and bandage up the little boy. And the whole time, you know, he's shaking like this. He's covered in blood. The screams. And we didn't have time to wait for a medic because this kid was going to bleed out. And so an American vehicle had approached the gate and were like, hey, you got to take this kid to the Swedish field hospital. He's not going to make it. You know, the Swedes had the hospital there. And so, boom, we load him up in the vehicle, and just like that, you know, he's out of my life, or, you know, so I thought. And he shows up in my nightmares, and the screaming is what I can't handle. I can handle the blood and the gore. The screaming, I can't handle the fucking screams. And in my nightmares, I can never, ever, ever, ever get that bandage on his freaking foot. You know, my doctors and my therapists have told me over the years, well, you know, Cleo, in real life, you did get the bandage on his foot, and you saved his life. And, you know, it's funny because people ask me, whatever happened to that kid? I'm like, I don't fucking know. It's not like I went and visited him in the hospital. You know, I'm sure he at least lost his left leg, you know. And a couple years ago, me and my gunner connected on Facebook, and we were talking about that day. And I tell him, you know, people ask me all the time, what happened to that kid? And I'm like, I didn't go visit him in the hospital. He goes, we did go visit him in the hospital. I said, what? He goes, yeah, you're right. He lost his left leg, We went to the Swedish hospital and visited him, and you know, we brought him some candy and some soda from the PX. I'm like, what? I said, dude, you could show me a video of me visiting this kid in the Swedish field hospital. I still wouldn't believe you. You know, why would I block out that memory versus the memory of the actual trauma of trying to take care of him and the screams and stuff? And I've come to the conclusion that it was because at the time of the, you know, bandaging him up and trying to get him help, I was helping him. And when I saw him in the hospital, I felt guilty because I couldn't save his leg, you know. And it's the only thing I can come up with. And my therapist have, you know, basically confirmed that that's, you know, probably why. So, anyway, so, you know, who knows what the hell happened in Somalia after that. I don't remember a lot. A lot of convoys, a lot of security missions. You know, we were working 18, 20-hour days in full combat gear in 130-degree weather, you know, hunting them while they hunt us. So, you know, it was really, you know, just Somalia is a horrible, horrible place. It was considered the most dangerous place on earth at the time we were there, and it still is to this day. And it baffles me to think that I spent 4 months in the most dangerous place on earth and got out alive. And I'm honestly, I don't know how any of us got out of there alive. And, you know, I don't know if you know, but later that year in October, the Battle of the Black Sea, which is commonly known to civilians as Black Hawk Down, if you've seen the movie. It's a true story. Yeah. Black Hawk Down, where we lost 18 Rangers in Delta Force, and had a POW, Michael Durant, who was captured and after his chopper was shot down and held as a POW for 11 days. so that's you know, I remember that day too. Devastating to me. It's almost like it happened yesterday when I found out that they had our guy, one of our guys, and I was an emotional wreck. And I was back in the States by then. Had been for, you know, about 5 months when that battle took place. But shortly after I got back to Fort Bliss, I was put on a task force, and me and my partner, we patrolled residential areas on mountain bikes. Easier to sneak up on domestic disputes, burglaries, that kind of stuff, you know, because you don't have the noise of the engine or the lights of a car. And I was losing it. I didn't want to admit to myself, I think, that I was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And, you know, I had all the symptoms. The anger, the irritability, the rage, the nightmares, the flashbacks, the sleeplessness, all kinds of stuff. Depression, suicidal, homicidal. And, It was really weird because on three different occasions while we were on patrol, I had what I guess would be considered trickery of the mind more than a hallucination, but we're patrolling through this residential neighborhood, and there was this red kind of poinsettia plant on a brick wall in front of a door. But what I saw was a severed head and all the junk hanging out. Look again, it's a plant. Another time, there was a small basketball goal, those small plastic basketball goals for children, and there was a red sweatshirt draped over it. But what I saw was a body impaled on a stick. Looked again, you know, it's a sweatshirt. And then the third time, there was a group of soldiers in a backyard, and they were sitting around a table playing cards and drinking beer. But what I saw was a group of soldiers that were bound and gagged. Looked again, you know. So I thought, I'm fucking losing it. So at some point, apparently, I threatened to kill my partner and then kill myself. And I let my squad leader know what was going on with me. And I came to my barracks room one morning. It was like 9 in the morning. And he's like, hey, we need you to go talk to a doctor. Said, fuck you, I'm not going to talk to a doctor. He goes, you know what? If you don't come with me, I'm going to get the commander. I said, get the fucking commander. I don't fucking care. So about 10 minutes later, he shows up with my captain, my commander, and he's like, you know, we need you to come with us. I'm like, fuck you, sir. I mean, this is how rageful I was. You don't talk to an officer that way, or any superior, right? And they said, listen, if you don't go with us, you know, we're going to have you strapped down. We're going to take you. Fine, can I take a fucking shower? So I took a shower, and my squad leader stood outside the latrine, you know, while I was taking a shower. And they drove me to William Beaumont Hospital. And I sat down with a full bird colonel, a psychiatrist, blah, 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 blah. I remember at some point he sat me outside in a chair outside his office. And a little while later, I see three of my brother MPs walk in. And I'm like, what are they here for? I'm like, well, we're going to take you to the psych ward. And they're here in case you give us any trouble. I'm not going to disrespect my brothers, you know. I'll go. So they take me to the psych ward and they take my clothes, put me in, you know, these pajamas, and there was a female private mental health tech, and she told me, she said, soldier, you're going to have to take off your dog tags. I said, fuck you, private. I said, the only way I take my dog tags off is if I'm having sex, and I'm not going to have sex in here. I'm a soldier 24/7. I don't take my dog tags off. So I told her to fuck off, and so I went in my room, and there was a camera in my room, flipping it off, and I was hungry because I'd been up since 9. They hadn't fed me. And I came out my room and I yelled, what the fuck is a fucking soldier supposed to do around this fucking place to get some fucking chow? And this major, female major nurse, she says, soldier, chow served at 1730. It'll be brought to your room. I said, fine, fuck you. And I go back in my room, flipping off the cameras. A little while later, I hear a knock at my door. And I look up and there's this man standing there. He's a patient. And he had an apple and a cookies and cream Hershey bar. And he goes, here you go, soldier. Heard you say you were hungry. I was like, oh, thanks, you know, chowing down. And he became my best buddy in there. But he said something to me that scared me to death and still, you know, even frightens me to this day when I think about this. And you got to remember, this was in 1994. He did 2 tours in Vietnam. And he was a police officer for 20 years. So you can only imagine what he has seen. And he said to me, he said, you know, Cleo, he goes, well, all the stuff I saw in Vietnam in 2 tours and all the stuff I saw as a police officer for 20 years, he goes, I've never seen so much violence and hatred in somebody's eyes as I see in yours. And that terrified me. And I'm like, really? And that's when I really started questioning my sanity. I'm like, you know, this guy has seen some stuff, and if he sees that violence and hatred in my eyes, there is something really, really wrong with me. I don't remember how long I was inpatient, but I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and bipolar, which is a bullshit diagnosis. And because I was diagnosed, I wasn't authorized to carry a weapon. And I was an MP. You have to carry a weapon as an MP. My first sergeant knew that I was a trumpet player, and so he had me try out for the 62nd Army Band. So I got attached to the 62nd Army Band, spent with them for my last 3.5 months in the Army, and I was a bugler for military funerals. I played taps. 5 days a week. I would play 3 or 4 or 5, 6 funerals a day. Fort Bliss, El Paso is a very big retirement community for veterans because of the weather and the military installation. So a lot of elderly people, veterans dying off. So You know, they take this combat vet with PTSD, and they put him in a cemetery playing the saddest song of the freaking world, you know. So I got out of the Army. I was accepted into a police academy, of all places, Las Cruces, New Mexico, where I was in college, where I wanted to be anyway. So I was out of the Army for about 3 days and started the police academy. I had been doing the testing and the training and stuff, application process throughout. So I started the police academy, and I was in the academy. I was the only female. And about 6 months into being a cop, I got fired for mental instability. They knew I had PTSD when I came in. So the sheriff's department picked me up as a deputy. And spent 6 months with them, got fired for mental instability. And, you know, all I knew was law enforcement. And so everything gets really fuzzy at this point. I believe I moved back up to northern New Mexico and piddled around for a while. At some point, I came to Phoenix, was working for a security company where I met my husband. We moved back to New Mexico. I got a job at Walmart working loss prevention, working undercover catching shoplifters. Best freaking job ever. My husband worked as a security officer at a casino. And a little over 2 years in, got fired for mental instability. My husband had had a heart attack, and I guess it would have been, so we got married in 97, so I guess he had his heart attack in 98 or 99. And so we moved to Michigan, which is where he is from, to be closer to his family. So we got to Michigan, very small town, and I got a job as a corrections officer at the county jail, which I loved. And spent a couple years there, fired for mental instability. Ended up going to the corrections academy for the state, 18-week academy, and became a corrections officer for a state prison. Worked there for 6 months. I actually quit that job. You know, I saw the officers there, been there 7, 10, 12 years, whatever, acting like convicts, walking like convicts, talking like convicts, and I'm like, you know, I'm not going to get institutionalized. So I walked away from that job. And so all this time, it had been 9 years since I'd been home from Somalia. And I had all the symptoms of PTSD. Hardly ever slept. Did as much overtime as I could. And I thought, I was too tough a cop, too tough a soldier to have any problems. And I hadn't cut for 6 years. And that was over the course of having met my husband and stuff. And I started cutting again. The depression was in full swing, the flashbacks, the nightmares. It was just, it was a horrible existence. So on 24 June of 2002, woke up, did the coffee and smoke, checked my email, piddled around. I remember playing solitaire almost all day long on my computer. It was about 4:30 that evening, that afternoon, I decided I'm going to kill myself. And so about 5 o'clock, a little after 5, I walked in the living room. My husband was asleep on the recliner in just a pair of denim shorts, no shirt, no shoes. And I walked quietly over the corner. I picked up my .22 rifle and my banana magazine. Walked quietly to the door and opened the door. And he woke up and he said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to the river." He said, "What are you going to shoot at the river?" I didn't say anything. I just left. And, you know, there should have been red flags flying everywhere because I'm not the type of person that just leaves with a rifle. I don't go out and shoot things. So I get in my vehicle. It was a King Cab Nissan pickup. Put the rifle in the King Cab, and I drive about 15 miles to the Pine River. And I back my truck up to the bank of the river, drop the tailgate. I get my rifle and the magazine and sit it on the tailgate, and I sit on the tailgate. I got the rifle and the magazine sitting to my right. And smoke a cigarette. I got my tape player in my truck playing. There was no CDs back then. Mm-hmm. I was wearing my hair was really long there. I had a ponytail. I was wearing a Colorado Rockies baseball cap. The ponytail was through the back. I was wearing my favorite Scooby-Doo t-shirt, baby blue denim shorts, and flip-flops. And had a cigarette, and and I had one of those Charm lollipops, you know, with a bubble gum in the middle. Bonus, you're done with a lollipop and you get gum, right? The dispatcher's son at the sheriff's office had given it to me. He was like 9 years old. I remember it was a cherry flavor. So I ate the lollipop, chewing on the gum, smoking another cigarette. And I just said to myself, it's time. I took my headgear off, set it on the left, took my sunglasses off, set it on the left. I picked up the rifle, put the magazine in, locked and loaded it around, took it off safe, put it to my face where I always cut, pulled the trigger, boom, just like that. I didn't sit there and cry and hold the gun to my head and pray and think about this and think about that. Nope, it was 1, 2, 3, 4, boom, 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 boom. And the impact threw me back. And then I came forward and the weapon went flying out of my hands. And there was blood from my eye, my nose, my mouth, my face, my ear. And I came off the tailgate and my equilibrium was off. And at the time I didn't know why, but later I found out the bullet fragments, a lot of them exited my ear. It was a hollow point, by the way. And so I come off the tailgate and I try to walk a little bit and my equilibrium's off and just bleeding profusely. And I remember thinking, I did it. I pulled the trigger. Holy shit, I'm still alive. I can still feel and think and hear. And I gotta do it again. Where's the rifle? Where's my face? And I still had that bubblegum in my mouth. And I had all this blood. And I remember thinking, I'm gonna choke on this fucking bubblegum. And I spit it out. And people were like, you just shot yourself in the head and you're worried about choking on bubblegum? Like, do you know how many people die from choking on bubblegum a year? You know? And so, I know, right? It's funny. Try to use a little humor, you know, in this. And so,
gotta.
Right. So I'm looking for the gun and I can't find the gun. And I'm bleeding everywhere. And the noise was just incredibly obnoxious. And I walk over to the passenger side of my truck about 7 yards away from it. And I collapse to my knees. And a pool of blood just forms. And then I fall to my stomach. And I can see the road about 25 meters out in front of me. And ironically enough, I crawled much like a wounded soldier on a battlefield, you know. And I stood up. I walked around the front of my truck to the driver's side and I saw my reflection in the window and my face was out to here, big as a basketball. And I was like, oh. So I opened the door, I pushed the seat forward, I reached in the king cab area, I pick up my military raincoat, I ball it up and I put it to my face. And I remember thinking, you idiot, this is a repellent of liquid, not an absorbent of liquid. So I throw it in the back of the truck. Walk around to the tailgate. I see the rifle in the grass on the bank of the river. I pick it up and it just slipped through my hands because of all the blood. I was covered from head to toe. Pick it up again, cradle it in my arms, and I set it in the back of the truck and I close the tailgate. Walk back to the driver's side, put the seat back, get in, close the door, adjust the seat, put my seat belt on because I'm a law-abiding citizen. I start the truck. I drive to the dirt road, turn right, drive about a half mile to a stop sign. I stop because I'm a law-abiding citizen. I turn left because I know that's towards town, right? I drive about a half mile and this noise is just completely obnoxious and I'm very, very weak. I'm losing an incredible amount of blood. And I see this woman walking down the road and I thought she was an angel. I thought I was hallucinating. I had been to this river hundreds of times, playing my guitar, fishing, writing, smoking, whatever. Never seen another soul, ever. And on this day, at this time, this woman's walking down the road. And I'm shocked. I stop the vehicle, put it in neutral, put the emergency brake on, take my seatbelt off, turn the tape player off, reach over, unlock the passenger door. I open the driver door, I stumble out, and I'm walking towards her, you know, all off skew like a zombie, you know. And I said, can you help me? And she's like, oh my God, what happened? And I said, I shot myself. She's like, oh my God, why? I said, listen, you're going to have to drive. And I turned around and I walked to the passenger side. She didn't hesitate a second. She got right in the truck and there was blood all over the door panel and the seat and the steering wheel. I get in, close the door, put my seatbelt on. She puts her seatbelt on. She takes the emergency brake off and she's fumbling with the gear shift. And I said, do you know how to drive a stick? She says, yeah, I'm just nervous. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm going to have to shift for her, right? So we start driving and I pull the visor down, which has a mirror. And I saw my reflection in the mirror, and it was devastating. And I went, ugh. And I pushed the mirror back up, and I put my head back on the headrest. And I closed my eyes, and she says, what's your name? I said, Cleo. She goes, Cleo, stay awake. Stay awake. Keep talking to me. Stay awake. I said, I'm tired. And she goes, Cleo, why would you do something like this? Don't you have kids? And I said, fuck no, I wouldn't bring up kids in this fucked up world. And I remember we're passing all these houses. We're out in the country. And I remember asking her, aren't you going to stop and call 911? And she says, no, I'm getting to the Pine River store. So we pull into the parking lot of this convenience store. And it's packed with people because they're buying all their fishing gear for night fishing. Now, the call came in, the 911 call came in at 1 minute to 7 p.m., 6:59 p.m. We pull in, she jumps out, I open the door, she runs over my, she says, sitting, I said, I want to get out. So I'm holding the side of my truck, guiding myself to the tailgate, leaning against the tailgate and the bumper, and sit down on the ground leaning against the bumper while she's inside calling 911. This woman runs over to me, she throws a blanket on me. I'm like, I'm not cold! And I threw the blanket. She goes, I don't want the kids to see all this blood. And I still have that blanket to this day. Mm-hmm. This man came up, this older gentleman, and he put his foot on my bumper, and he's like this on his knee, and he looks down at me, he goes, what's your name? Cleo. He goes, how old are you, Cleo? 32. He goes, why would you do something like this, Cleo? I said, who are you? He goes, oh, I'm Bob. And I said, what are you, Bob, a fucking reporter? And his buddy's like, leave her alone until the cops get here. So I'm sitting there, and so like I said, the call came in at 6:59 p.m. At 7 p.m., a minute later, the first deputies arrived on scene, and they're personal friends of mine, because I worked at the sheriff's office. Mm-hmm. I couldn't see out of the side, my right side, because it was swollen shut, just blown out. And so Brian came around, I saw Brian, and I said, hey, Bri. He's like, oh my God, Cleo, was that you? And he just collapsed to his knees, and he put on these blue rubber gloves. He's like, oh my God, Cleo, oh my God, did something happen with Dennis? I said, no, Bri, I just wanted to die. He said, oh my God. And I saw Mark walk by, and I said, Mark, you got to secure the weapon. There's a round in the chamber. It's not unsafe. You got to secure the weapon. He's like, don't worry, Cleo. I'll take care of the weapon. Just listen to Brian. See, I'm still thinking military, police, you know, safety. And so the ambulance shows up a minute later, and they didn't know where the bullet had exited, so they put a C-collar on me and put me on a board. My blood pressure was like 80 over nothing. They started an IV. They couldn't put the oxygen mask on my face because it was blowing out, so they had to hold it kind of skewed for me to get oxygen. And the noise, again, was still, you know, obnoxious. And so they got me in the ambulance, and I remember seeing all the bright lights, you know. And I couldn't hear anybody because I couldn't hear out of this ear. And, you know, I could see their mouths moving. They were panicked, and I couldn't say anything because they were holding the mask. And so they're flying Code 3 lights and sirens to the hospital. And this poor medic, it was her first trauma call. She was young. And en route to the hospital, she says, I have to put a tube down your throat. Your blood pressure's dropping. I said, fuck you. You're not touching me. I said, I know what that is. That's life support. I said, I'm conscious. I'm alert. I'm talking. Get the fuck away from me. I was very combative. I was just full of rage. So they get me into the emergency room. They cut off my shirt, my bra, my favorite Scooby shirt. One of the deputies was my husband's cousin. And he had come on scene, saw that it was me. So he ran lights and sirens to my house. He ran into the house, and he told my husband, get in your shirt and your shoes on, and your wife just shot herself. And I can't imagine what that was like for Dennis, you know. I remember him walking in the emergency room and looking at me laying there, and he's just like, why would you do something like this, Cleo? I said, don't you fucking start with me, Dennis. This is the third person who's asked me this in the course of, what, 15, 20 minutes? So they thought all the bones in my face were shattered and they were going to have to do reconstructive facial surgery. So they were going to transport me to Saginaw, Michigan, 40 miles away to a St. Mary's hospital. And my husband said, well, I'm going to go with you. And he said, no, you're not going to come with me. You know, just go home and call my brother in Arizona. So they transport me to St. Mary's, and we pull up to the emergency room, and the nurses are rushing out to help the paramedics get me. And one of the nurses said, she goes, wow, you're our most popular patient. You're not even here yet. What the fuck are you talking about? She said, the phone's been ringing off the hook for you. And I was like, who the fuck is calling me, you know? They put me in this glass room. The nurse said, you want me to bring the phone in? I said, sure. So she brings the phone in, and I said, hello. And it was my little brother. We were very, very close at the time. He was 6 years younger than me. Toughest guy I've known. And he was bawling. He said, why would you do something like this, Cleo? You're my rock. What would I do without you? And he goes, this is the worst day of my life. And I said, yeah, it was a pretty good day for me too, Dale. And he goes, did Dennis do this? And I started laughing. I'm like, what? Dennis wouldn't have the balls to do this. He goes, I don't believe you. You would never do something like this. You're way too strong. He goes, I'm coming down there. And I said, Dale, you don't need to come down here, spend the money, leave work. You just, I'll be fine. Because I'm coming down there and you're going to look me in the eyes and tell me you did this. So by this time my head was all wrapped up in a very bizarre way because the wound's here below my right eye. And they have to keep my nose and my mouth free so I can breathe. So it was, and blood was matted. I mean, I wasn't cleaned up. It was all in my fingernails and between my fingers. And my best friend was a deputy, and his name is also Dale, same as my younger brother. And he was off that day, and I knew he was off. What I didn't know is that he was en route to my house, but he didn't call and say, hey, I'm coming over. And he had stopped at a convenience store to buy a can of chew and a bottle of water and met up with a buddy. They decided to go throw a line in the water, so he never made it to my house. Had he got there before, would I have done it the next day? Would I have ever done it? Who knows? You know, probably not even relevant. So dispatch immediately called Dale once they found out who the victim was. And initially he was like, fuck her. She's my best friend. Yeah, I'm not going to go see her. She wants to go out like this. She wanted to fucking talk to me. Fuck her. And then he broke down crying. And then he got angry. Then he broke down. He's like, well, you know, she is my best friend. No, I'm going to go see her. So he walked in the emergency room a little after midnight. And I'm sitting up in the bed. My head's all wrapped up weirdly. And I'm eating a chicken salad sandwich. And he walks in. He goes, you're eating? And I said, yeah. He goes, how could you eat? I said, I'm hungry. I haven't eaten all day. And he goes, what the fuck? I said, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to say, Dale? He goes, does it hurt? I said, yeah. He goes, good. I said, that's fair. And then he looked me dead in the eyes, and he said something to me that just, it drug a knife through my heart, and I'll never forget it to this day. And for that split second, what I saw in my best friend's eyes was confusion, hurt, pain, anger, sorrow. And he looked me dead in the eye, and he said, what happened to my friend? I just want my friend back. And it was the only time in the 13 years and 6 months, whatever it's been. Yeah, 6 months. 13 years and 6 months that I ever felt guilty about shooting myself. And there's actually a piece in my book called I Just Want My Friend Back. Mm-hmm. I just dedicated to him. And so I don't remember. It couldn't have been the next day because my brother couldn't have got there that fast. So it was probably the day after. Him and my younger brother, two youngest brothers lived here in Arizona. They flew to Chicago. My oldest brother lived in Wisconsin. He drove to Chicago, picked him up, and they drove to Michigan. And they were smoking dope, you know. Mm-hmm. And they were discussing how they were going to kill Dennis because they said they thought Dennis did this. And they had a video recorder, and they were going to record him publicly apologizing to me, and then they were going to murder him on tape. You see, everybody in my life thinks I'm so strong, you know, because I went through the child abuse and the military and the combat, and Cleo would never do something. She's way too strong, you know. Surprise! So I get up that morning, and I got my IV pole, and I went into the bathroom. I used the bathroom, and then I had this bright idea to brush my teeth, which, you know, didn't work too well because my face was blown out. So I gave up. I walked outside the bathroom into my room, and all three of my brothers were standing there. And I said, what the fuck are you guys doing here? And I crawled back into my bed, and my younger brother goes, holy shit, I got a lot more respect for 22s. And my oldest brother's like, holy shit. And my youngest brother, Dale, he's like, fucking A. And he looks at me and he goes, did you do this? I looked him dead in the eye. I said, yeah, Dale, I did this. He goes, what the fuck? What do you want me to say? You know, what do you say? You know, I mean, imagine my surprise when I realized I was alive. When I shot myself, that I was going to face all these people. You know, you never think you're going to face them when you attempt suicide. You know, you got some splaining to do, you know. So they got me on video. The nurses, the doctors wouldn't let them photograph me or videotape me for about 6 days because the damage was just too extensive. So they got me on video, apparently, at some point. And there's actually a video of them back at my house, and my brother is sitting at our kitchen table, and he has my rings and my watch and my POWMI bracelet, my dog tags, and he's cleaning the blood off of them with Q-tips and alcohol pads, and they brought him back to me to the hospital. But they couldn't clean the blood out of the truck. They couldn't face that at all. So, and I've only seen this video for the first time 2 years ago. My brother refused to let me see it. But he finally broke down and gave it to me a couple years ago. It's pretty remarkable. So at that point, obviously, your next stop is the psych ward. So my best friend, she was a childhood friend. We went to college together and stuff. She lived in Chicago, and she had come down that night. She drove me to Ann Arbor, to the VA. And I walked onto the ward, and the bullet hole's right here. You kind of see a indention there. And it was bleeding profusely for like 2 weeks. I had to carry Kleenex around with me because it just bled constantly. And they hadn't cleaned me up completely. I mean, I had taken a shower. I couldn't figure out why my ear hurt. And my ear still had a lot of blood caked onto it. And the psychiatrist told the nurses, "You get the soldier cleaned up right now." They sat me in a chair, and they started cleaning my ear with alcohol and a cotton ball. And there was a patient standing. He's like, "Look, there's a hole, there's a hole." I'm like, "What?" And that's when we first knew that a lot of the fragments had exited my ear. If you could see right here, it tore the snub off. You see the scars with the shrapnel.
Yeah.
And it went out the bowl of the ear right there. So a hollow point expands and spreads. So all the bones in my right side of my face were broke. They were clean breaks. So I spent, 4.5 months in the psych ward, and they didn't even know how to treat me. I was so sick. I was so symptomatic. Their only goal was to keep me alive. You know, of course, they put me on antidepressants and antipsychotics and mood stabilizers. Had my own room. I was the only female on the ward. Had a camera, of course. You couldn't get your privileges for 3 days to go out and smoke and wear your civilian clothes. I never got mine for 6 days because I was considered a high risk and always had to have an escort. And so over the course of the next year, I was in and out of the hospital. I'd be out for 2 weeks and back in, out in, out in. And I was doing 30, 45 days at a time, and I was heavily medicated. When I got out the first time, I drove back to that convenience store. I remember it was raining really hard, and I ran into the store, and I said to the clerk, I said, "You remember about 4.5 months ago, someone was brought in here who had shot themselves?" She goes, "Oh, yeah, it was you. Hi, Cleo." I said, "You know me?" And she goes, "I'm the one that put the blanket on you." I said, "Oh, yeah, you probably don't want that blanket back." And I said, "Hey, you wouldn't happen to know the name of the lady who brought me here, would you?" She goes, "Yeah, her name's Cindy Carruthers, and she works right across the street at that school for the developmentally disabled." So I drove over there. I run in the building. I see this lady, and I said, "You know, I'm looking for Cindy McCuthers." She goes, "Hi, Cleo." She goes, "I'm Cindy." I'm like, "You recognize me?" And she goes, "Yeah." She goes, "You know, I've been keeping up with your progress, you know, through the deputies and stuff." I said, "Can I ask you something?" I said, "You know, I've been to this river hundreds of times. I've never seen anybody." I said, "What were you doing that day? What were you doing out there?" She goes, "You know, I was walking towards my friend's house. We were walking towards each other to meet each other." And she goes, "It's a good thing you ran into me instead of her, because her husband shot and killed himself. She would have never been able to handle it." And I'm thinking, God, you know, this is insane, you know. So I thanked her. We talked briefly, and I have no recollection of that. My truck had been sitting there for months, splattered with blood. My brothers couldn't handle cleaning it out. So I called my buddy Jess, who was my father figure, about 70 years old. And I said, "Hey, can you do me a favor?" And he's like, "Sure." And I said, "Can you help me clean the blood out of my truck?" He goes, "Yeah, bring it over." So I drove over to his house. We got a bucket of soapy water, sponges, hose, you know, scrubbed it. We couldn't get it out of the seat. You know, it was cloth, but we had to get seat covers. But we got the majority of it out. And I divorced my husband. I didn't want to put him through this emotional merry-go-round roller coaster that I was on. I knew there was going to be many hospitalizations, breakdowns, probably more suicide attempts. And so I divorced him and moved to Bay City, about 40 miles south of that, and stayed there in an apartment. I was in and out of the hospital, tons of medication. They tried DBT, EMDR, tried all that on me, didn't work. I tried to hypnotize me, didn't work. I was just incredibly sick. So they diagnosed me with severe post-traumatic stress disorder. And I left Michigan in, I believe, 2003, and I moved out here to Arizona. I had got my Social Security disability within 2 months of the shooting, and I had applied for my military disability. I got the military disability, I think, in 2004. So I bought a house and a vehicle, outfitted the house and stuff here in Arizona, and that's where I've been ever since. And so since the shooting, I've been hospitalized 32 times in psych ward, some court ordered. Every medication known to man. My best friend was Haldol. had a couple psychotic breaks. I had two more suicide attempts in 2009. I tried by carbon monoxide. Loaded my dogs in the same truck that I shot myself in. I sat there for like 45 minutes. My eyes are, you know, running. My nose is running. Everything's burning. I said, geez, how long does this carbon monoxide thing take, you know? And I got out of the truck and the cloth had fallen out. So I just gave up. Didn't get hospitalized, but I didn't even hardly tell anybody about that one. And then in 2010, so 5 years ago, a little over 5 years ago, March 23rd, I OD'd on 90 Ativan tranquilizers and was rushed to the hospital and woke up 3 days later, you know, in the hospital. That was my last suicide attempt. In 2008, you know, I had been hospitalized numerous times, was in therapy twice a week, back and forth to the VA constantly, tons of medication, but I wasn't getting any better. I wasn't even, you know, maintaining. And the doctors at the VA decided that the medication wasn't working, so the last resort for depression and suicide is ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, electric shock therapy. So they shocked my brain 3 times a week for 6 months. I've had 180 shock treatments to my brain. And all it really succeeded in doing is shredding my memory. It wasn't working. It didn't work. It made me more paranoid. I got suicidal halfway through the treatments, had to be put in the psych ward, right here in Scottsdale, actually. I wasn't getting better. And I was literally living in the dark. I would lay in my bed in the dark for hours, just thinking of ways to hurt myself and kill myself. And I was just, that emotional distress is just beyond my ability to describe that kind of pain. You know, it hurts. It hurts, hurts. And I started going back to church and got involved in my church and Celebrate Recovery and was giving my testimony, reading from my book. There was a time where I didn't leave my house except on Tuesdays to go to therapy. And I was so bad that I was having my groceries delivered. I had my groceries delivered for over a year. I was scared to leave. I was super paranoid. Before I would walk out my back door to smoke in my yard, I would check my neighbor's roof for snipers. I was just a wreck. I was a wreck. I was not functioning. I wasn't participating in my life at all. I was heavily medicated on the Ativan, which would knock me out for 12 to 14 hours. I'd be awake maybe 8 hours, back to sleep. No energy, lethargic, super depressed, cutting several times a week. You know, it was out of control. I can't even describe that pit of darkness that I existed in. I was just enveloped, you know, by the darkness. It had its claws in me. And all I wanted to do was die. You know, it's all I thought about. At some point, and I'll never do this again, I called the suicide hotline. And I was doing I don't remember very well, but apparently I was part of some mental health program. And by this time, I had been training in Kenpo karate, and I was a green belt. And Kenpo is a very violent, aggressive art. And so they knew my history. And so instead of sending help, I'm sitting there on my couch, and my phone rings. I'm like, hello? And the guy says, hey, this is Officer So-and-so from Mesa Police Department. I said, all right. He goes, how you doing? I said, I'm doing fine. He goes, let me ask you something. He goes, do you have any weapons in the house? I said, yes, sir. I have a 380 automatic. He says, where is it? I said, it's unloaded in a gun case in my closet. He goes, okay. He goes, hey, would you mind stepping outside for me? I'm like, sure. Mm-hmm. So I open my door and I step outside. There's a SWAT team out there. I mean, I'm talking the van, the SWAT van, 8 patrol cars, and they got shotguns and M16s and pistols pointed at me. They're screaming, get down, get down, get down, get down. So I got down on my stomach, you know, spread eagle, and like 4 officers, you know, one on my neck, one on my hip, you know, and they're cuffing me, and I'm like, what the fuck is going on? And they said, a doctor wants to talk to you. You sent a SWAT team for a suicidal person? And they said, well, you know, with your combat experience, military police, police law enforcement, civilian law enforcement, corrections, and martial artists, you're the type of person that could really fuck us up, so we're not taking any chances with you. Like, what? So they sent me to some civilian psych ward, and my cousin called my therapist the next day, and he got me out there within an hour. He said, what the fuck are you guys doing? Pulling M16s and shotguns on a PTSD combat vet. What's wrong with you people? Yeah, I'll never call the suicide hotline again. You know, the local police know my history, have been to my house a couple of times, and they told me, you know, anytime we come here, just so you know, there's going to be a lot of cops and a lot of guns, you know, because I'm the type of person with all my training that could, you know, I would never disrespect my brothers and sisters in blue. Why would you think I would do that? You know, I mean, short of a psychotic break, you know, where I wasn't even in control, maybe, you know, but, see, I just, that's not going to happen again. So I got involved in the warfighter community on Facebook, a group of military veteran community, and I continue to write. I'm a writer, I'm an author, and that's my catharsis. You know, I purge onto paper. You know, every word that I write is a drop of blood from my tortured soul, you know. And so I published a couple books, and I travel around the country doing speaking engagements, talking about suicide prevention and the awareness and PTSD. You know, I have a traumatic brain injury from the explosion in Somalia, from the gunshot, and obviously 180 shock treatments probably didn't help. So that's why my memory is so bad. But earlier this year in January, my manager, she's the one that gets me all my speaking gigs. She lives in South Carolina. She called me up and told me about this PTSD TBI treatment program in Bethesda, Maryland. And I went out in February. I stayed there in a hotel for 60 days, and I did 3 treatments a week, and it's biofeedback. And they just put electrodes on your head. You sit there for 4 minutes, completely quiet, with your eyes closed. That's it. You don't have to talk about your trauma. It's non-invasive. There's no pain. And basically what happens is it causes the synapses to fire and communicate, and it heals the broken part of the brain, basically regenerates it, takes all the noise out. So basically the way the doctor explained it to me, she said, think about a game going on inside of your head, and since your traumatic brain injury, half the team's been on the bench. So when the synapses communicate and it restores it, now all the players are in the game. So my brain has been restored. about 4 years ago, I woke up with a Boston accent. Never been to Boston before. Never. People from Boston thought I was from Boston. It's called foreign accent syndrome. It's a result of a TBI that can manifest years later. Then I woke up with a stutter. So I was a stuttering Boston accent. And I feel like I speak pretty well, you know. So I don't have the speech impediment with this accent. Foreign accent syndrome. I researched it. It's very rare. So I show up to Maryland with a Boston accent, stuttering, all these horrible, severe PTSD, TBI symptoms. And after the first treatment, the stutter was gone. After the second treatment, the accent was gone. And throughout the course of the 25 treatments I did in 60 days, all my symptoms are gone. I haven't had a single nightmare, no flashbacks, no suicidal ideations, no depression. The quality of sleep I get, phenomenal. I weaned myself off all my psych meds in March while I was in the hotel room. So I'm psych med free since March, and I had been on it for 13 years, heavily dosed. No anger, no rage, no irritability, no paranoia. It's gone. Everything's gone. All the hurt and all the pain that I've endured for 45 years, gone. Gone. It's like God reached down his hand, put his head on my shoulders. There you go, kid. Let's try again. God chose to heal me. He took it all away, everything. I got back 31 March. I saw my therapist who had been with for 4.5 years. I saw him twice for debriefing sessions. Mm-hmm. So now I haven't been in therapy since April. first time in 13 years that I haven't been in therapy, that I haven't been on psych meds. All the symptoms are gone. For years, I was just full of rage and anger. I thought the gun was a sure thing, you know, and I was so pissed the guy didn't let me die. I'm like, really, dude? Yeah, I shoot myself in the head? You know, so for a lot of years, I was just full of this rage and anger. And probably my worst symptom, other than suicidal ideations, was my irritability. And I just feel for the people who are in my life, you know, walking on eggshells all the time around me. They didn't know when I was going to go off. You know, stupid shit, little shit. My sister-in-law left a pack of crackers on my counter. I put her in a headlock, was attacking her. I don't remember it, but my family's told me about it. My brother had to pull me off. You know, stuff like that. And so all this stuff is gone. I have been symptom-free, you know, since probably mid-March. And it's amazing. I've been on this road of now discovery of who the not-sick Cleo is anymore. You know, for a long time after the treatment, there was a little part in the back of my mind waiting for the other boot to drop. You know, symptoms are going to come back. You know, but short of another traumatic event or TBI, the symptoms aren't going to come back. I'm healed. I'm, like, truly healed. And one of the interesting things, you know, I know a lot of people don't believe in God, and that's, you know, up to them. But there was a series of miracles that happened that day when I shot myself. One, I never lost consciousness. And some people take a punch in the face and they're out for the 10 count. I was able to drive. That woman was walking down the road. What? 2 years ago, I went and saw a plastic surgeon at the VA to remove the shrapnel from my face because it gives me a lot of pain. And I walked to his office and he had my CT scan up on the screen. It was just lit up like the night sky. And he goes, let's count these bullet fragments. We stopped counting at 60. So I have over 60 bullet fragments in my face. And he said, you know, if I cut your face, he goes, first of all, I can't locate all the shrapnel because they're on different layers of your skin, some all the way down on your bone, in the cartilage of my ear. He said, if I cut your face, there's a 100% chance I'll cut a nerve and a muscle, which will leave your face paralyzed. You won't be able to open your right eye, and the right side of your mouth will droop. Well, answer me this, Doc. How did the initial 60 fragments go through my face without cutting a nerve or a muscle? We don't know. It's a medical miracle. There's no explanation for it. You figure 60 fragments flying through your face. I've never had a single surgery. No paralysis. A little bit of numbness. That was it. This scar is not from the shooting. This is scarification. You know what scarification? Okay, so this is scarification, which I got a couple years ago. But yeah, so 60 bullet fragments that initially flew through my face didn't cut a nerve or a muscle. The doctors have no explanation for it. You would think at least one. Statistically. No. People don't even know. They can't even tell that I shot myself in the face. You know, people thought I was going to look like a monster, you know, and nope. Now, I don't know what you thought, because you knew, yeah. You know, that I shot myself in the face. But, yeah, so, you know, this is a series of miracles. And today, you know, my last book came out on March 23rd. It's called Trigger Pieces. And it's a series of writings, what people call poetry. I don't call it poetry. You know, my stuff's not roses are red, violets are blue, you love me, I hate you. It's more like roses are red, violets are blue, I'll lay down suppressive fire for you. And, right? It's, you know, some dark stuff about depression and cutting and suicide, combat, stuff I saw as a cop. Some are written from actual events, some are from nightmares, some are from just stuff rattling around in my military mind, stuff like that. And, you know, I go around the country and I do speaking engagements for groups and veteran groups and, you know, let them know that, you know, even as a suicide survivor, times three for me, you know, there's hope. And I'm living proof that there's hope. I'm living proof. Especially with the brutal attempt of the gunshot, you know. People still can't wrap their minds around that. Still to this day, if I go to a new doctor, you know, and they find out, they look at me like I'm an alien. People look at me like I'm an alien when they find out that I had shot myself in the face and lived. Mm-hmm. And I think what's so compelling about this story is the fact that I never lost consciousness. And I took actual steps in saving my life. And I remember everything, the thought process, everything, you know, the bubble gum. You know, had I lost consciousness and been found or woke up, the story I don't think would be near as compelling, you know, because I remember everything that happened. And the doctors don't understand that either. With a head injury like that, how my memory could be so clear. So, you know, it's interesting, and you know, I mean maybe God had it happen that way so that I can go forth and be strong and help other people and say, hey, you know, I know it sucks. It sucks. I know what it's like to be on both ends of the rifle. You know, I know what it's like to feel that unsurmountable pain, that emotional distress where all you want to do is die. You know, I hate when people say the suicide is selfish, and it's I hate that it's they say it's a permanent solution to a temporary problem. Let me tell you something. PTSD is not a temporary problem. It's something you live with 24/7, moment to moment to moment to moment. You know, it's a coward's way out. No, you know, it's not. And I hate all those cliches that people have. And I understand, you know, people don't educate themselves about it unless they're impacted directly by it. So the stigma behind it, which is why I'm glad you're doing this project, because, you know, those who complete a suicide, you know, they're remembered, they're talked about. Those who are suicidal, you know, they get help. But what about those who attempted? You know, you're ousted from your community. Oh, you're crazy, you're weird, you know. People always just wonder when the next time I'm going to attempt, you know, is Cleo going to get it right this time, you know, that kind of stuff. And it's exhausting for them, and it's exhausting for me. You know, all those late night crisis phone calls, you know, when I was emergency Cleo, and just in that darkness of constant depression and the cutting, and it exhausts the people in my life and exhausts me. And you know, none of that's happened since the treatment, you know, because I am truly healed, not even cured, healed. And so I think I would just say to those who are suffering from suicidal ideations or as a suicide attempt survivor, considering it again, you know, wait an hour. Reach out, you know, step out of that darkness and reach your hand into the light. Take somebody's hand. You know, there's got to be somebody who's going to understand you. You know, if it's not a family or a friend, you know, there's so many resources out there that you can call, that you can contact. You know, on Facebook alone, they have tons of them. And, you know, just don't give up. And my motto is never surrender. It's been my favorite song, Never Surrender, by Corey Hart from back in the 80s. And, says no one can take away your right to fight and never surrender. And I have it tattooed on my arm right there, never surrender. I end my radio show with that on Wednesday nights when I talk on the radio. and my motto, my hashtag that I sign off on every Facebook post is nobody dies today. Because 22 of my brother and sister veterans are perishing by their own hands every day, 22 a day. And it's actually higher than that statistically. And so, you know, it's my mission to, you know, if I can impact and change and save one life, it's worth it. And you go on to the next one, and the next one, and the next one, until we're so strong that the suicide has no ground to stand on. You know, he's an asshole. He's a beast. He's a monster. He's conniving. you know, he infiltrates the lives of people at their weakest moments and exploits their weakness and whispers in the ear and talks in the ear and screams in the ear. Do it. Nobody cares about you. You're a burden. You're worthless, you know. no one's going to care. No one's going to miss you, you know. You're going to feel better. You know, all the lies that the suicide tells to us, you know, it gets deafening to where that's the only voice you can hear. You can't even hear your own voice, you know. He's got such a spot in the real estate of our brain, in our mind, to do that. And I really do wish more people would educate themselves on this this epidemic. It's an epidemic. Every 40 seconds in this world, somebody commits suicide. It's the fourth leading cause of death in America right now. You know, and it's a devastating, debilitating place to be when you're swallowing those pills, putting that gun to your head, tying that noose, running that razor blade across your wrist, driving at 180 miles an hour. You know, when you get to that point, the point of no return, when you cross that threshold, into where you're actually taking action. It's dangerous. It's a dangerous. It's very dangerous. And, you know, the red flags and the things that we say and do that are indications that we're heading down that road, people don't want to recognize them. They don't want to see them. They recognize them. They don't want to admit it to this. Oh, they're going to be fine. They're going to be fine. And then they get that phone call. Yeah. So-and-so killed themselves. And so it's my mission to save lives through my writing, through my speaking. You know, God has given me the gift of the written word and the spoken word, and he has blessed me with a gift to write. And, you know, he's given me this life, this story. You know, I thank God for every microsecond of my life, good, bad, ugly, whatever, because it made me who I am today. And he trusted me. He has trusted me with this affliction. He has trusted me with my history and what I've done. He knows that I'm not going to go out and slaughter 100 people, that I'm going to take this pain and help others. And if what I went through 10 years ago, 12 years ago, 15 years ago, somebody's going through right now, and I can help them, and they can get through it in 2 months versus 10 years, bonus. So, nobody dies today.